Come on, that's not stupid. It's normal to forget things sometimes. Almost all the kids got too much sun today. By teaching our children to sift through the activity of their mind, we can help them recognize the different rim points at work within them and help them gain more insight and control in their lives. Notice, too, how integrated the whole process is when it comes to how the brain takes in different stimuli. The nervous system extends throughout our body, functioning like powerful antennae that read the different physical sensations from our five senses. Then we draw on the images from the right hemisphere of the brain, combining these with the feelings that arise from the right brain and the limbic system. Then, ultimately, we link everything together with the conscious thoughts that originate in our left hemisphere and the analytical skills from our upstairs brain. Sifting helps us understand the important lesson that our bodily sensations shape our emotion, and our emotion shapes our thinking, as well as the images in our mind. The influences go the other way, too. If we are thinking hostile thoughts, we can increase a feeling of anger that in turn can make our body's muscles tense up. All of the points on the rim, sensations, images, feelings, and thoughts, can influence the others, and together they create our state of mind. The next time you have a few minutes in the car with your kids, play the sift game, asking questions that aid the sifting process. Here's an example of how you can begin. I'll mention something about what the sensations of my body are telling me. I'm hungry. What about you? What's your body saying? The seatbelt feels scratchy on my neck. Oh, that's a good one. I'll adjust it in a minute. What about images? What pictures are going through your mind? I'm remembering that hilarious scene from your school play and you in that funny hat. I'm thinking about the preview we saw for that new movie. The one about the aliens? Yeah, we've got to see that. Now feelings. I'm really feeling excited about Grandma and Grandpa coming tomorrow. Me too. Okay, S, I, F, now T for thoughts. I just thought about how we need milk. We'll need to stop before we get home. What about you? I've been thinking that Claire should have to do more chores than me since she's older. I'm glad you're so good at coming up with ideas. We'll have to give that one some more thought. Even if things get silly, the sift game is a good way to give your kids practice at paying attention to their inner landscape. And remember that just by talking about the mind, you help develop it.
Whole brain strategy number 10. Exercise mindsight, getting back to the hub. We've talked about the power of mindsight and focused attention. When kids become fixated on one set of points on their wheel of awareness, we need to help them shift their focus so that they can become more integrated. They can then see that they don't have to be victims of the sensations, images, feelings, and thoughts within them, and decide how they think and feel about their experiences. This doesn't come naturally to children, but they can readily be taught how to focus their attention back to the hub. We can give them tools and strategies for calming themselves and integrating their different feelings and desires. One of the best ways parents can do this is to introduce them to mindsight exercises that help them get back to the hub. When we help our children return to the hub of their wheel, we help them become more focused and centered so they can remain aware of the many rim points affecting their emotions and state of mind. Here's how one mother, Andrea, helped her 9-year-old, Nicole, get back to her hub so she could deal with her anxiety about an upcoming music recital. On the morning of the recital, Andrea realized that Nicole was understandably nervous about playing her violin in front of her friends and their parents. She knew her daughter's feelings were normal, but she also wanted to help her become less stuck on her rim. So she introduced her to a mindsight exercise. Andrea had Nicole lie flat on the sofa, and she sat in the chair next to her. Then she began to help her daughter become more aware of what was going on inside her. Here's the gist of what she said. "Okay, Nicole, while you're lying still, move your eyes around the room. Even without moving your head, you can see the lamp over on the table. Now look over at your baby pictures. See them? Now look at the bookcase. Can you see the big Harry Potter book there? Now look back at the lamp. Do you see how you have the power to focus your attention all over this room? That's what I want to teach you about. But we're going to focus your attention on what's going on inside your mind and body. Close your eyes and let's focus on your thoughts and feelings and senses. Let's start with what you hear. I'm going to be quiet for a few seconds and you pay attention to the sounds around us. What do you hear? That car going by? The dog barking across the street? Do you hear your brother running the water in the bathroom? You're aware of those sounds simply because you got still and focused on hearing them. You listened on purpose. Now I want you to notice your breathing. First, notice the air coming in and out of your nose. Now feel your chest going up and down. Now notice the way your stomach moves each time you breathe in and out. I'm going to be quiet again for a few seconds. During that time, stay focused on your breath. Other thoughts will come into your mind, and you'll probably even think about the recital. That's fine. When you notice that your mind is wandering, and you're thinking about something else or starting to worry, just go back to focusing on your breath. Follow that wave of the in-breath and the out-breath. After a minute or so, Andrea had Nicole open her eyes and sit up. Andrea explained that this technique is a powerful way to calm the body and mind. She told her to keep this exercise in her pocket for when she needed it, for instance, just before the recital. If she began to feel her heart pounding just before she played her violin, she could return to thinking about her breath coming in and going out, even with her eyes open. You can see how a calming mindset exercise like this could be a simple but powerful tool to help a child deal with fears and other challenging emotions. Plus, mindset exercises lead to integration, because, as you know, where we focus our attention, neurons fire and become active, and then wire to other neurons. In this case, when Andrea helped Nicole focus on her breath, she was not only addressing her feelings of anxiety, she was also helping her daughter return to her hub so she could notice other parts of herself and even physical sensations that she could then intentionally change. So her neurons associated with mindfully focusing on her breath became wired to her neurons related to feelings of calm and well-being. She moved into a completely new state of mind and was able to get back to her hub. While this example focuses on an older school-age child, younger kids can benefit from mindset exercises as well. Even as young as 4 or 5, kids can learn to focus on their breath. A good technique is to have them lie down and place a toy, like a boat, on their stomach. Ask them to focus on the boat, watching it rise and fall as it rides the waves of the breath. But we're not suggesting that mindset exercises require a person to lie down and enter a meditative state. One of the best tools you can give your kids for when they feel anxious or afraid, or even when they're having trouble falling asleep, is to teach them to visualize a place where they feel calm and peaceful. Floating on a raft in a pool, sitting next to a river they remember from a camping trip, or swinging in a hammock at their grandparents' house. Mindset exercises lead to survival, which can help kids manage their anxieties, frustrations, and, for older children, even intense anger. But these strategies lead to thriving as well. After Andrea introduced Nicole to the MindSight exercise before her recital, where she ultimately relaxed and played beautifully, they returned to similar exercises from time to time, with Andrea leading Nicole through certain visualizations like the one above. As she grew older and kept practicing, Nicole began to understand more about the hub of her wheel, so she could get back to it more easily and quickly. She learned to focus more precisely and specifically on the parts of herself that she wanted to develop and grow. Watch for ways to help your children learn to be still and calm at times and find the deep ocean peacefulness within their hub. From there, they'll be better able to survive the storms brewing within them from moment to moment, and they'll have a better chance of thriving emotionally, psychologically, socially, as they grow toward adulthood. Whole brain kids. Teach your kids about integrating the many parts of themselves. We've already given you several examples of how other parents have introduced their children to MindSight and the power of focused attention. Here's a story that you can use to help your own child understand the concept. Choosing what you think about. Do you ever feel like you get stuck on a feeling or a thought? Maybe an unhappy one that's so powerful it makes you forget about other feelings and thoughts that make you happy or excited? The good news is that you don't have to stay stuck on feelings that upset you. You can learn to focus on other parts of yourself and get unstuck. For example, Nassim couldn't stop thinking about the spelling bee. He even had a stomachache. He didn't feel like eating his lunch or playing at recess. All he could think about was spelling. He was nervous. Then his teacher, Ms. Anderson, taught him about his wheel of awareness. She explained that our minds are like a bicycle wheel. At the center of the wheel, called the hub, is our safe place where our mind can relax and choose what it thinks about. On the rim of the wheel are all the things Nassim could think about and feel. How he likes playing baseball at recess, what surprise his mom could have packed in his lunch, and, of course, his nervousness about the spelling bee. She explained that he was only focusing on the nervousness point on his rim and ignoring the other parts. Ms. Anderson had Nassim close his eyes and take 3 deep breaths. She said, "You've been focusing on your worries about spelling. Now, I want you to focus on the part of your wheel that has fun playing baseball and the part that can imagine a yummy lunch." He smiled and his stomach started to grumble. When Nassim opened his eyes, he felt better. He had used his wheel of awareness to focus on other feelings and thoughts, and he had changed how he felt. He was still a little nervous, but he wasn't stuck on just the nervousness. He learned that he doesn't have to think only about nervous feelings and that he can use his mind to think about other things that can help him have fun and not feel so worried. Nassim ate his lunch and ran outside to play baseball.
Integrating ourselves, looking at our own wheel of awareness. There are many ways parents can benefit from an understanding of MindSight and their own wheel of awareness. Let's take a moment so you can see and experience what we're talking about. From your hub, sift through your own mind. What rim points have your attention right now? Maybe some of these? I'm so tired. I wish I had just one more hour of sleep. I'm also irritated that my son's Yankees cap is there on the floor. Now when he gets home, I'll have to ride him about that and about his homework. Dinner with the Coopers will be fun tonight, but I kind of wish we weren't going. I'm tired. I wish I did more for myself. At least I'm giving myself the pleasure of reading a book these days. Did I mention I'm tired? All of these sensations, images, feelings, and thoughts are the rim points on your wheel of awareness, and together they determine your state of mind. Now let's see what happens when you intentionally direct your attention to other REM points. Slow down for a few seconds. Get quiet within yourself and ask yourself these questions. What's something funny or adorable my child said or did lately? Even though it's monstrously difficult at times, do I genuinely love and appreciate getting to be a parent? How would I feel if I didn't get to be a parent? What's my child's favorite t-shirt right now? Can I remember her first pair of shoes? Can I picture how my child might look at 18, bags packed and leaving for college? Feeling different? Has your state of mind changed? MindSight did that. From your hub, you noticed the REM points on your own wheel of awareness, and you became aware of what you were experiencing. Then you shifted your focus, directing your attention to other REM points. And as a result, your entire state of mind changed. This is the power of your mind, and this is how it can literally and fundamentally transform the way you feel about and interact with your kids. Without MindSight, you can get stuck on your rim, feeling primarily frustrated or angry or resentful. The joy of parenting is gone in that moment. But by returning to your hub and shifting your focus, you can begin to experience joy and gratitude about getting to parent your children just by paying attention and deciding to direct your attention to new REM points. MindSight can also be immensely practical. For example, think of a moment right now about the last time you got angry with one of your children. Really angry, where you could have lost control. Remember what he did and how furious you felt. At times like these, the anger you feel burns bright and fiery on the rim of your wheel. In fact, it burns so intensely that it far outshines other rim points that represent the feelings and knowledge you have about your kids. Your understanding that your 4-year-old is acting like a normal 4-year-old. Your memory of laughing hysterically together just a few minutes earlier as you played cards. The promise you made that you were going to stop grabbing your children's arms when you're angry. Your desire to model appropriate expressions of anger. This is how we become swept up by the rim when we're not integrated via the hub. The downstairs brain takes over any integrative functioning of the upstairs area, and other rim points are eclipsed by the glare of this single point of your all-consuming anger. Remember flipping your lid? What do you need to do in a moment like this? Yep, you guessed it. Integrate. Use your MindSight. By focusing on your breath, you can at least begin to get back to the hub of your mind. This is the required step that allows us to pull back from being consumed by a single angry point on the rim, or a few of them. Once in the hub, it becomes possible to take in the wider perspective that there are other rim points to keep in mind. You can get some water, take a break and stretch, or give yourself a moment to collect yourself. Then, once you've brought your attention back to your hub, you'll be free to choose how you want to respond to your child and, if necessary, repair any breach in your relationship. This doesn't mean ignoring bad behavior. Not at all. In fact, one of the rim points you'll integrate with the others is your belief in setting clear and consistent boundaries. There are many perspectives you can embrace, from desires for your child to act in a different way to feelings of concern over how you've acted in response. When you link all these different rim points together, when you've used the hub to integrate your mind at that moment, you'll feel a readiness to continue attuned, sensitive parenting. Then, with your whole brain working together, you can connect with your child because you are connected within yourself. You'll have a much better chance of responding the way you want to, with mindsight and the wholeness of who you are, instead of an immediate reaction spurred on by a fiery point on the rim of your wheel. To do your own wheel practice, go to drdansiegel.com. That's drdansiegel.com.
Chapter 6. The Me-We Connection. Integrating Self and Other. Ron and Sandy were fed up. Their 7-year-old, Colin, was a good kid. He didn't cause trouble at school, his friends and their parents liked him, and he generally did what he was supposed to do. But he was, in his parents' words, totally and incurably selfish. He always grabbed the last slice of pizza, even if he still had some on his plate. He begged for a puppy, then showed no interest in even playing with it, much less using the pooper scooper. Even after growing out of his toys, he still refused to let his younger brother play with them. Ron and Sandy knew that a certain amount of egocentrism in children is normal, and they didn't want to change Colin's personality. They wanted to love him for who he was. But at times, it drove them crazy that he often seemed incapable of thinking about other people. When it came to relational skills like empathy, kindness, and consideration, Colin just seemed to be missing the development of that circuit. The breaking point came one day after school when Colin disappeared into the bedroom he shared with his 5-year-old brother, Logan. Ron was in the kitchen when he heard yelling from the boy's room. He went to investigate and discovered a distraught Logan, furious with his big brother and crying over a pile of artwork and trophies. Colin had decided to redecorate the room. He had taken down all of Logan's watercolor paintings and marker drawings hanging on the walls and replaced them with his own posters and baseball cards, which he taped in rows across the largest wall in the room. In addition, he had removed Logan's 2 soccer trophies from the shelf and set up his own bobblehead dolls in their place. Colin had piled all of Logan's belongings in a corner of the room, he explained, so they wouldn't be in the way. When Sandy got home, she and Ron talked about their frustration with their older son. They sincerely believed that there was no malice in Colin's actions. In fact, that was almost the problem. He never even considered Logan's feelings enough to intend to hurt him. He redecorated the room for the same reason he always took the last slice of pizza. He just didn't think about others. This issue is a common one for parents. We want our kids to be caring and considerate so they can enjoy meaningful relationships. Sometimes we fear that because they're not as kind or compassionate or grateful or generous as we want them to be, they never will be. Of course, we can't expect a 7-year-old to behave as if he were an enlightened adult. Sure, we want our kids to become men and women who are strong and forgiving and respectful and loving, but that's a bit much to expect of someone who's just recently learned to tie his shoes. However, while it's important to trust the process and know that much of what we want for our kids will emerge only over time, we can prepare them and steer them toward becoming children, teens, and ultimately adults who are fully capable of participating in relationships and considering the feelings of others. Some people simply have fewer neural connections in their circuitry in charge of empathy and relationships. Just like kids who have trouble reading need to practice and grow those connections in their brains, kids who have difficulty relating to others need to have those connections encouraged and cultivated. And just as a learning disability is a sign of a mental challenge, so is an inability to feel someone else's pain. It's a developmental issue, not necessarily a character problem. Even children who don't seem predisposed to connection and compassion can learn what it means to be in relationship and to fulfill the responsibilities that come with it. That's what this chapter is about. Most of the information we've provided in earlier chapters focuses on how to help develop your child's whole brain in order to develop a strong and resilient sense of me. But like Ron and Sandy, You know that kids need just as much help understanding what it means to become a part of a we, so that they can be integrated with others. In fact, in our ever-changing modern society, learning to move from me to we may be essential for how our children will be able to adapt in our future world. Helping children become a participating member of a we while not losing touch with their individual me is a tall order for any parent. But happiness and fulfillment result from being connected to others while still maintaining a unique identity. That's also the essence of Mindsight, which you'll remember is all about seeing your own mind as well as the mind of another. It's about developing fulfilling relationships while maintaining a healthy sense of self. In the previous chapter, we discussed the first aspect of Mindsight, seeing and understanding our own mind. We talked about helping kids become aware of and integrate the many different parts of themselves via the wheel of awareness. The key concept in this aspect of Mindsight is personal insight. Now we want to turn our attention to the second aspect of Mindsight, developing the ability to see and connect with the minds of others. This connection depends on empathy, on recognizing the feelings, desires, and perspectives of another. Ron and Sandy's son seem to need empathy skills. In addition to developing and integrating his whole brain and the different parts of himself, he needed to be given lots of practice at seeing things from other people's perspectives, seeing other people's minds. He needed to develop this second aspect of Mindsight. Insight plus empathy equals Mindsight. Insight and empathy. If we can encourage these attributes in our kids, we will give them the gift of Mindsight, offering them awareness about themselves and connection with those around them. But how do we do that? How do we encourage our kids to connect with family, friends, and the world while cultivating and maintaining their own individual sense of self? How do we help them learn to share, to get along with siblings, to negotiate playground politics, to communicate well and consider others' feelings? The answers to all these questions emerge from the me-we connection, which we can understand by first looking at how the brain participates in the creation of relationships.
The social brain, wired for we. What do you picture when you think about the brain? Maybe you recall an image from high school biology class, that weird organ floating in the jar, or a picture of it in a textbook. The problem with this single skull perspective, where we consider each individual brain as a lone organ isolated in a single skull, is that it neglects the truth that scientists have come to understand over the last few decades, that the brain is a social organ made to be in relationship. It's hardwired to take in signals from the social environment, which in turn influence a person's inner world. In other words, what happens between brains has a great deal to do with what happens within each individual brain. Self and community are fundamentally interrelated, since every brain is continually constructed by its interactions with others. Even more, studies of happiness and wisdom reveal that a key factor in well-being is devoting one's attention and passions to the benefit of others instead of just focusing on the individual, separate concerns of a private self. The me discovers meaning and happiness by joining and belonging to a we. To put it differently, the brain is set up for interpersonal integration. Just as its many different parts are made to work together, each individual brain is made to relate with the brain of each person we interact with. Interpersonal integration means that we honor and nurture our differences while cultivating our connections with one another. So while we want to help our kids integrate their left and right brain, their upstairs and downstairs brain, their implicit and explicit memories, and so on, we also need to help them understand the extent to which they are connected to their family, friends, classmates, and other people in their communities. By understanding basic facets of the relational brain, we can help our kids develop the mindset that will allow them to enjoy deeper and more meaningful relationships. Mirror neurons, the reflectors in the mind. Do you ever get thirsty when you see someone take a drink? Or yawn when someone else does? These familiar responses can be understood in light of one of the most fascinating recent discoveries about the brain, mirror neurons. Here's how the discovery took place. In the early 1990s, a group of Italian neuroscientists were studying the brain of a macaque monkey. They had implanted electrodes to monitor individual neurons, and when the monkey ate a peanut, a certain electrode fired. No surprise there. That's what the researchers expected. But then a scientist's snack changed the course of our insight into the mind. One of the researchers picked up a peanut and ate it as the monkey watched. In response, the monkey's motor neuron fired, the same one that had fired when he had actually eaten the peanut himself. The researchers discovered that the monkey's brain was influenced and became active just by watching the actions of another. Whether the monkey witnessed an action or performed that same behavior himself, the same set of neurons became activated. Scientists immediately began scrambling to identify these mirror neurons in humans. And while there are far more questions than answers about exactly what they are and how they work, we are actively learning more and more about the mirror neuron system. These neurons may be the root of empathy and therefore contribute to mindsight in the human brain. The key is that mirror neurons respond only to an act with intention where there's some predictability or purpose that can be perceived. For example, if someone simply waves her hand in the air randomly, your mirror neurons won't respond. But if that person carries out an act you can predict from experience, like taking a drink from a cup of water, your mirror neurons will figure out what's intended before the person does it. So when she lifts up her hand with a cup in it, you can predict at a synaptic level that she intends to drink from it. Not only that, the mirror neurons in your own upstairs brain will get you ready to drink as well. We see an act, we understand the purpose of the act, and we ready ourselves to mirror it. At the simplest level, that's why we get thirsty when others drink, and why we yawn when others yawn. It may be why even a newborn infant, just a few hours old, can mimic his parents when he sticks out his tongue. Mirror neurons may also explain why younger siblings are sometimes better at sports. Before they ever join their own team, their mirror neurons have fired each of the hundreds of times they've watched their older siblings hit, kick, and throw a ball. At the most complex level, mirror neurons help us understand the nature of culture and how our shared behaviors bind us together, child to parent, friend to friend, and eventually spouse to spouse. Now let's take another step. Based on what we see, as well as hear, smell, touch, and taste, in the world around us, we can mirror not only the behavioral intentions of others, but also their emotional states. In other words, mirror neurons may allow us not only to imitate others' behaviors, but actually to resonate with their feelings. We sense not only what action is coming next, but also the emotion that underlies the behavior. For this reason, we could also call these special neural cells sponge neurons, in that we soak up like a sponge what we see in the behaviors, intentions, and emotions of someone else. We don't just mirror back to someone else, but we sponge in their internal states. Notice what happens when you're at a party with friends. If you approach a group that's laughing, you'll probably find yourself smiling or chuckling even before you've heard the joke. Or have you noticed that when you're nervous or stressed out, your kids will often be that way too? Scientists call this emotional contagion. The internal states of others, from joy and playfulness to sadness and fear, directly affect our own state of mind. We soak other people into our own inner world. You can see then why neuroscientists call the brain a social organ. It's absolutely built for mind sight. We are biologically equipped to be in relationships, to understand where other people are coming from, and to influence one another. As we've explained throughout the book, the brain is actually reshaped by our experiences. That means that every discussion, argument, joke, or hug we share with someone else literally alters our brain and that of the other person. After a powerful conversation or time spent with an important person in our life, we have a different brain. Since none of us is working from a single skull mind, our whole mental life results from our inner neural world and the external signals we receive from others. Each of us is meant to join our individual me with others to become a part of we.
Laying the groundwork for connection, creating positive mental models. What does all this mean for our children? The kinds of relationships they experience will lay the groundwork for how they relate to others for the rest of their lives. In other words, how well they'll be able to use their mindsight to participate in a we and join with others down the road is based on the quality of their attachment relationships with their caregivers, including parents and grandparents, but also significant babysitters, teachers, peers, and other influential people in their lives. When kids spend time with the most important people in their life, they develop important relational skills like communicating and listening well, interpreting facial expressions, understanding nonverbal communication, sharing, and sacrificing. But also in relationships, children develop models about how they themselves fit into the world around them and how relationships work. They learn whether they can trust others to see and respond to their needs, and whether they feel connected and protected enough to step out and take risks. In short, they learn whether relationships will leave them feeling alone and unseen, anxious and confused, or felt, understood, and securely cared for. Think of a newborn. A baby is born ready to connect, ready to link what she sees in others with what she does and with what she feels inside. But what if those others are only rarely attuned to what she needs? What if, more often than not, her parents are unavailable and rejecting? Then confusion and frustration will initially permeate the child's mind. Without intimate moments of consistent connection with her caregivers, she may grow up without mindsight, without an understanding of the importance of joining with someone else. We learn early in life to use our connections with reliable others to soothe our internal distress. This is the basis of secure attachment. But if we aren't given such nurturing, our brain will need to adapt and do the best it can. Children can learn to go it alone in an effort to soothe themselves as best they can. The relational, emotional circuitry of this child's brain, which needs closeness and connection that are not being offered to her, may completely shut down as a way of adapting. This is how the social brain shuts down its innate drive for connection just to survive. However, if her parents can learn to show her consistent, predictable love and attunement, she will develop mindsight and live up to the relational potential her brain has been wired for. It's not just parents who create the strategies of adaptation or the mental models, for how children view relationships. Think about what your children are learning from their relationships with various caregivers, like the coach who emphasizes the importance of working together and making sacrifices for teammates, or the aunt who is hypercritical, who teaches that a central part of a relationship involves disapproval and finding fault, or the classmate who views all relationships through the lens of competition, seeing everyone as a rival or adversary, or the teacher who emphasizes kindness and mutual respect and models compassion in her interactions with the children in her class. All of these different relational experiences wire a child's brain for what a we feels like. Remember that the brain uses repeated experiences or associations to predict what to expect. When relationships are cold and people are essentially distant, critical, or competitive, that influences what the child expects relationships to feel like. On the other hand, if the child experiences relationships full of nurturing warmth, connection, and protection, then that will become the model for future relationships with friends, with other members of various communities, and eventually with romantic partners and their own children. It's really not an exaggeration to say that the kind of relationships you provide for your children will affect generations to come. We can impact the future of the world by caring well for our children and by being intentional in giving them the kinds of relationships that we value and that we want them to see as normal. Preparing for we, offering experiences that lead to connection. In addition to modeling good relationships for our kids, we need to prepare them to join with others so they'll be capable of becoming a part of a we. After all, just because the mind is equipped and designed to connect with others doesn't mean that a child is born with relationship skills. Being born with muscles doesn't make you an athlete. You need to learn and practice specific skills. Likewise, children don't emerge from the womb wanting to share their toys, nor are their first words, "I'll sacrifice what I want so we can strike a mutually beneficial compromise." On the contrary, the phrases that dominate the vocabulary of toddlers, mine, me, and even no, emphasize their lack of understanding of what it means to be a part of a we. So they have to learn mindset skills like sharing, forgiving, sacrifice, and listening. Colin, Ron and Sandy's son, who seems so egocentric, is for the most part a very normal kid. He just hasn't quite mastered many of the mindset skills that are necessary for participating as a contributing member of a family. His parents' expectation was that by the time he was 7, he'd be more integrated into the family and willing to be a part of a we. While he's steadily improving his relational intelligence, he needs practice to keep moving in that direction. The same goes for a shy child. Lisa, a mom we know, has pictures of one of her sons at his friend's 4th birthday party. All of the children are gathered in a tight circle around a young woman dressed like Dora the Explorer. All, that is, except for Lisa's son Ian, who insisted on standing 6 feet away from the circle of not-so-shy kids. It was the same at his toddler music class. While the other children sang and danced and itsy-bitsy spidered their little hands off, Ian sat in his mom's lap and refused to do anything more than timidly observe. In those years, Lisa and her husband had to walk the line between encouraging new relationships and pushing too hard. But by giving their son repeated opportunities to interact with other children and to figure out how to make friends, all while supporting and comforting him when he was nervous or afraid, they helped their young introvert develop the social skills he needed. And while these days Ian is still not quick to dive headfirst into new social situations, he is very comfortable with himself and even outgoing at times. He looks people in the eye when he talks to them, raises his hand in class, and is even frequently the ringleader in the dugout for a very enthusiastic rendition of Take Me Out to the Ball Game. Researchers who study human personality tell us that shyness is to a large extent genetic. It's actually a part of a person's core makeup present at birth. However, as in the case of Ian, that doesn't mean that shyness isn't changeable to a significant degree. In fact, the way parents handle their child's shyness has a big impact on how the child deals with that aspect of his or her personality, as well as how shy the child is later on. The point is that parenting matters, even to the extent of influencing our inborn and genetically shaped temperament. We can help prepare our kids to join with others and experience meaningful relationships by offering encouragement and opportunities that help them develop those mindset skills. We'll talk in a minute about some specific ways to do that. But first, let's explain what we mean by helping kids be receptive to being in relationships.
Cultivating a yes state of mind. Helping kids be receptive to relationships. If we want to prepare kids to participate as healthy individuals in a relationship, we need to create within them an open, receptive state instead of a closed, reactive one. To illustrate, here's an exercise Dan uses with many families. First, he'll tell them he's going to repeat a word several times, and he asks them just to notice what it feels like in their bodies. The first word is no, said firmly and slightly harshly 7 times, with about 2 seconds between each no. Then, after another pause, he says a clear but somewhat gentler yes 7 times. Afterward, clients often say that the no felt stifling and angering, as if they were being shut down or scolded. In contrast, the yes made them feel calm, peaceful, even light. You might close your eyes now and try the exercise for yourself. Notice what goes on in your body as you or a friend says no, and then yes, several times. These two different responses, the no feelings and the yes feelings, demonstrate what we mean when we talk about reactivity versus receptivity. When the nervous system is reactive, it's actually in a fight, flight, freeze response state, from which it's almost impossible to connect in an open and caring way with another person. Remember the amygdala and the other parts of your downstairs brain that react immediately without thinking whenever you feel threatened? When our entire focus is on self-defense, no matter what we do, we stay in that reactive no state of mind. We become guarded, unable to join with someone else by listening well, by giving them the benefit of the doubt, by considering their feelings, and so on. Even neutral comments can transform into fighting words, distorting what we hear to fit what we fear. This is how we enter a reactive state and prepare to fight, to flee, or even to freeze. On the other hand, when we're receptive, a different set of circuits in the brain becomes active. The yes part of the exercise, for most people, produces a positive experience. The muscles of their face and vocal cords relax, their blood pressure and heart rate normalize, and they become more open to experiencing whatever another person wants to express. In short, they become more receptive. Whereas reactivity emerges from our downstairs brain and leaves us feeling shut down, upset, and defensive, a receptive state turns on the social engagement system that involves a different set of circuits of the upstairs brain that connects us to others, allowing us to feel safe and seen. When interacting with our kids, it can be extremely helpful to decipher whether they're in a reactive or a receptive state of mind. This, of course, requires mindsight on our part. We need to consider where our kids are emotionally, and where we ourselves are at any given moment. If your four-year-old is screaming, "I want to swing longer," as you carry her under one arm away from the park, that may not be the best time to talk to her about appropriate ways of handling big emotions. Wait until this reactive state passes. Then, when she's more receptive, talk to her about how you'd like to see her respond the next time she's disappointed. Likewise, when your 11-year-old finds out that he didn't get accepted into the art program he'd set his heart on, you may need to hold off on word-heavy pronouncements of hope and alternatives. The downstairs state of reactivity doesn't know what to do with a lot of upstairs words. Often, in moments of reactivity, nonverbals, like hugs and empathetic facial expressions, will be much more powerful. Over time, we want to help our children become more receptive to relationships and help them develop mindsight skills that will let them join with others. Then receptivity can lead to resonance, a way of joining from the inside out that will allow them to enjoy the depth and intimacy that come with meaningful relationships. Otherwise, a child is left adrift, motivated by a sense of isolation rather than a desire and ability to join. One final note before we turn to steps we can take to encourage receptivity and relational skills. As we help children be more receptive to joining with others, we need to keep in mind the importance of maintaining their individual identity as well. For a 10-year-old girl who's doing everything within her power to fit in with a clique of mean girls at school, the problem may not be that she's not receptive enough to joining a we. The concern for her may be just the opposite, that she's lost sight of her me, and is therefore going along with everything this set of bullies tells her to do. Any healthy relationship, whether it's family, friendship, romantic, or otherwise, is made up of healthy individuals in connection with others. To become a part of a well-functioning we, a person needs also to remain an individual me. Just as we don't want our kids to be only right-brained or only left-brained, we also don't want them to be only individualistic, leaving them selfish and isolated, or only relational, leaving them needy, dependent, and vulnerable to unhealthy and harmful relationships. We want them to be whole-brained and enjoy integrated relationships.
What you can do. Helping your child integrate self and other. Whole brain strategy number 11. Increase the family fun factor, making a point to enjoy each other. Do you ever feel like you're spending most of your time either disciplining the kids or carting them from one activity to the next, and not enough time just enjoying being with them? If you do, you're not alone. Most of us feel this from time to time. Sometimes it's easy to forget to just have fun as a family. Yet we are hardwired for play and exploration as well as for joining with one another. In fact, playful parenting is one of the best ways to prepare your children for relationships and encourage them to connect with others. That's because it gives them positive experiences being with the people they spend the most time with, their parents. Of course, children need structure and boundaries and to be held accountable for their behavior. But even as you maintain your authority, don't forget to have fun with your kids. Play games, tell jokes, be silly. Take an interest in what they care about. The more they enjoy the time they spend with you and the rest of the family, the more they'll value relationships and desire more positive and healthy relational experiences in the future. The reason is simple. With every fun, enjoyable experience you give your children while they are with the family, you provide them with positive reinforcement about what it means to be in loving relationship with others. One reason has to do with a chemical in your brain called dopamine. Dopamine is a neurotransmitter, which means that it enables communication between brain cells. Your brain cells receive what some people call dopamine squirts, when something pleasurable happens to you, and it motivates you to want to do it again. Scientists who study addiction point to these dopamine surges as factors that lead people to maintain a certain habit or addiction, even when they know it's bad for them. But we can also help produce dopamine squirts that reinforce positive and healthy desires, like enjoying family relationships. Dopamine is the chemical of reward, and play and fun are rewarding in our lives. What this means is that when your son squeals in delight, when you dramatically dive from his Peter Pan sword thrust, when you and your daughter dance together at a concert or in the living room, or when you and your kids work together on a gardening or construction project, the experience strengthens the bonds between you and teaches your kids that relationships are affirming, rewarding, and fulfilling. So give it a shot, maybe even tonight. After dinner, call out, "Everybody take your plate back to the kitchen. Then find one blanket and meet me in the living room. We're having popsicles in a fort tonight." Another fun family activity that also teaches receptivity is to play improv games together. The basic concept is similar to what improv comedians do when the audience gives them suggestions and the comedians have to take the random ideas and combine them in funny ways that make some sort of sense. If you and your kids are performers, you can actually do this kind of improv together. But there are simpler versions of the activity as well. Let someone begin a story. Then, after one sentence, the next person has to add to it, followed by the next person, and so on. Games and activities like these not only keep the family fun factor high, but also give kids practice at being receptive to the unexpected turns life presents them. You don't want to turn the game into a serious classroom experience, but watch for ways to explicitly connect what you're doing to the concept of receptivity. Spontaneity and creativity are important abilities, and novelty also gets dopamine going. The fun factor principle also applies to the experiences you give your kids as siblings. Recent studies have found that the best predictor for good sibling relationships later in life is how much fun the kids have together when they're young. The rate of conflict can even be high, as long as there's plenty of fun to balance it out. The real danger comes when the siblings just ignore each other. There may be less tension to deal with, but that's also a recipe for a cold and distant relationship as adults. So, if you want to develop close, long-term relationships between your kids, think of it as a math equation where the amount of enjoyment they share together should be greater than the conflict they experience. You're never going to get the conflict side of the equation to zero. Siblings argue, they just do. But if you can increase the other side of the equation, giving them activities that produce positive emotions and memories, you'll create strong bonds between them and set up a relationship that has a good chance of remaining solid for life. Some sibling fun will occur naturally, but you can help it along, too. Break out a new box of sidewalk chalk and have them create a crazy new monster together. Let them use the video camera to make a movie. Have them team up together for a surprise project to give to a grandparent. However you do it, family bike rides, board games, making cookies, teaming up against mom with the water guns, whatever. Find ways to help your kids have fun together and strengthen the bonds that connect them. You can also use fun and even silliness to shift your children's state of mind when they become stuck in an angry or defiant state. Sometimes they won't be in the mood to have you act silly or playful. So be sensitive to the cues you receive, especially with older kids. But if you're sensitive to how your playfulness will be received, this can be an extremely powerful and easily implemented way to help children shift how they are feeling. Your state of mind can influence your child's state of mind, letting you transform fussiness and irritability into fun, laughter, and connection.
Whole brain strategy number 12, connection through conflict. Teach kids to argue with a we in mind. We might wish we could somehow help our kids avoid all conflict, but we can't. If they're going to be in relationships, they're going to face quarrels and disagreements. We can, though, teach them some basic mindset skills so they'll know how to manage conflict in healthy and productive ways and respond when things don't go perfectly as they interact with others. Once again, each new disagreement is more than